Hello there. Welcome to Roam FM. Here we dive into the minds, workflows, and machinations of the Roam cult, the believers of Roam research. My name is Norman Chella, and I am on a mission to deconstruct wisdom from all walks of life so we can understand each other better. In this episode, we talk with Richard Meadows, who is a finance writer, investor, and journalist. After quitting his full-time job at age 25, he has been pursuing his own hobbies and research interests while traveling around the world. He is also the author of Optionality, How to Survive and Thrive in a Volatile World. Optionality, the book, lays out the time-tested strategy for not only becoming resilient to shocks, but also positioning yourself to profit from an unpredictable world, especially in the world that we are living in right now. I reached out to Richard because I found out something very fascinating about him. He is the first Roman. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Richard is the very first user of Roam Research, having met Connor at a retreat in India in 2017, being the first test user of Roam Research before it was shown to the rest of the world. So in this episode, we talk about Richard's origin story, from being a business reporter in New Zealand to writing about finance and quitting his full-time job at age 25 and figuring out what to do next, preparing his life for optionality and seeing what ideas should he pursue, including one which he thought was quite stupid, but still, I enjoyed listening to that, and how he stumbled into Roam, from being in Thailand and making the big trip to India to meet the one and only Connor. Being the first beta tester of Roam, how did his workflow improve over time? We look at Richard's writing workflows in figuring out what is considered a page, what is queried, what is nested underneath headings, and much more. His latest book, Optionality. We talk about what it is, how can we apply it to our lives right now, to other non-financial domains, and thrive in a volatile world or unstable world where we can prepare for a future which is ambiguous and still unknown, but have as many options as possible for us to choose and make the correct decisions. So a huge section of optionality right here. And I ask Richard about why asking yourself what's your 10-year plan is a stupid question and what is a better question to ask yourself instead. The different domains that optionality can be applied to, how to prepare yourself and take the first few steps to allowing these opportunities to arrive at your doorstep, and optionality and Roam. How can you use Roam to figure out what options are the best for you? It's really interesting to see how Roam can fit as a tool and as a home base for Richard to do all his writing, all of his management, all of the things that make up the different aspects of his life to put into one knowledge graph, and a whole range of other topics that we've talked about as well. So diving into this, the final episode of this season, let's dive into my chat with Richard Meadows, the author of Optionality, How to Survive and Thrive in a Volatile World.
I think this is like, it's expected actually for two Romans to be on a conversation. And of course our graphs are open to the point where we are talking or writing down notes about this conversation right now, talking about Roam. But I might as well get right into it since we still have this energy up right here. So, Richard, welcome to Roam FM. I know that you, as written or as tweeted out by Connor online, you are the first Roman, I believe. I think that's what he said. And I do have the tweet here. So there's already something special. There's this like special relationship, at least how I see it, with you and Roam Research. But there has to be a time when you were riding on the deep dish, you were doing your calisthenics, you're doing bodybuilding, you were eating 222 pizzas in a row for multiple days, which
Done your homework.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I have. I have, you know, other than my graph, I have like 20 tabs open right now. Before you stumbled into Roam, there are all these things that you were doing. So could you tell me a little bit of your origin story? What were you doing before you discovered the tool Roam Research, and how did you do that?
Yeah, sure. So my background is I started my career as a business reporter in New Zealand, which is where I'm from. And I enjoyed that very much and learned a lot, but I started spinning my wheels after a few years and started looking for exit strategies. So I ended up leaning hard into frugality and the early retirement movement. and saved a bunch of money. And once I had enough of a safety buffer, I quit my job and got rid of all of my worldly possessions and moved overseas. So I roamed around Asia for I think it would have been probably just over 2 years. And the idea there was to get some distance and free up enough time to work on projects that I thought might be more personally satisfying or higher leverage or just sort of stimulating, even if they weren't financially rewarding. Yeah. So this was actually where my sort of my optionality philosophy first started to develop, just the idea of maximizing my surface area for serendipity to strike and putting myself in the kind of environments where I might find something of interest to that would sort of capture my attention without knowing in advance what that would actually be. So I had a bunch of ideas before I left, and some of them seem pretty stupid looking back. So I didn't really act on any of them actually. I ended up going down quite a different path, and one I couldn't have anticipated in advance. So the Rome connection is that it directly arose out of this approach. So what's the story? So I was in Thailand. I was hosting couch surfers at my apartment just because, again, I thought it would be a nice way to meet people and inject a bit of serendipity into my social scene. So I met a couple of Americans, one of whom was the then girlfriend of Connor, and we really hit it off. And she told me that I had to meet her boyfriend because we had so much in common. And she invited me to come to a retreat in India later on that year. So on the strength of that, I just sort of dropped everything and booked a ticket to India.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's quite a jump. Wow.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's a really unlikely story, but so many of my most fulfilling relationships have sort of come about through things of that nature, where I just sort of took a shot and it paid off. And also this is the sort of privilege of being, you know, a little wisp and just having a backpack full of stuff and not having a mortgage and not having a full-time job.
Yeah.
Or children or anything like that. So this is it's part of my sort of staying nimble strategy when I was, you know, very, very young in my early mid-20s. So anyway, the long story short, I met Connor at that retreat, and he told me what he was working on. And we hit it off and started. He didn't have anyone really sort of on his team at that point. So I started helping him test the product and talking about product and features and design and trying to figure out how to get this thing to work. So yeah, that's how it came about. Let me know if you want me to say more about, you know, which bits are of particular interest. But that's how Rome came into my life.
Yeah. So let's pause on that for a little bit, because you did mention you had some ideas and some of them seemed pretty stupid. Do you still remember those ideas?
oh man, come on. oh God. Okay. So one of them was just before I left New Zealand, I was big into like physical fitness, physical culture.
Yep.
And I think I wanted to start like a New Zealand specific website for like powerlifting and strength sports news. And then I was going to make money through affiliate marketing of protein powder and creatine and stuff like that. So I don't know if that would have actually been a viable business, but it's also just not a very grand vision, just to have a little modest, sports supplement affiliate website. I don't know, maybe I'll end up doing that, but it quickly sort of fell out of consideration as other options opened up.
It seems like it could be possible.
I'm sure there were stupid ones.
Yeah. No, don't worry. That seemed like a pretty, shall we say, safe idea, in that you can tell that it might be a market and you have an affiliate link with, you know, protein powder. And I believe New Zealand has a pretty strong powerlifting culture, or at least, you know, a strong gym culture where a lot of people there are working out. I've been to New Zealand a few times and I can see people are three times my size, so I can see that you may have an audience there. Maybe you can focus on that.
I'll put that on the back burner and see if anything comes of it.
And on the time when you met Connor and he was working on this, you said he was working on this solo, so he hasn't met Josh yet.
This is March of 2017.
March 2017.
And then I didn't meet Josh until summer of 2019, at which point he must have been there for at least 6 months or a year or so.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, this is Connor like out in the wilderness, basically. you know, like living cheaply cheapish in India. Hacking away on this thing, very early prototypes at this stage.
Yeah.
And yeah, no funders and no users or investors or no Rome cult. And I imagine, I don't know, it was quite funny. He's sort of he's a real character, as I'm sure you will have picked up upon. So yeah, it really does seem like this strange prophet wandering out in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights or maybe 40 months. And, but we got along really well, and the early prototypes, I could already see the potential in them because I was already sort of peripherally interested in this space, although I wasn't an expert in it at the time. And they were immediately useful, I think, for me more conceptually than in the sense of building something that would last, because I've got like a graveyard of dead Rome prototypes. Where all my notes have gone to die. So I've had I've had to start over several times when the direction changed. So that's the sort of the early stages of Rome, pre-Josh and pre the final, the product that we all know and love. This was very much just, like, I think the hard problem really was, I'm not a technical person, so I can't really speak to that side of things, but like as far as I could see, the hard problem is like conceptually figuring out how, like, what this product should look like, and having to do that from a place where all the status quo is like a completely different paradigm, so you have to constantly be trying to not get sucked back into that. Like a lot of the earlier ones were trying to figure out like vertical taxonomies, like parent and child relationships, and everything has to be nested within a sort of a phylum. It was quite cool to see that develop. I'm not claiming any credit here. Like Connor is definitely the product guy, but I think I was mostly just a person to bounce ideas off and report bugs to and tell him what I wanted from it and what was and wasn't working. So I wanted him to, the earliest version of this was like, I was the only guy using it. So I was like, this is what I want you to build for me. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to program. Now go away and build this for me. So that was quite fun. It was work.
So it's like Richard, the writing app for like the whole of 2017, 2018.
I mean, that's actually quite funny, isn't it? Because they say that you should sort of start off in an incredibly narrow and target one specific niche or use case before you scale and go broad. So that's about as niche and specific as you can get, isn't it?
yeah, it is.
Let's make one person happy.
Yeah, there's something interesting you touched on there, because the taxonomies and the new, I wouldn't say new, but the different ways of thinking when looking at one's notes that Rome is trying to teach at the time. It feels like just even trying to get to the point where a new user comes in, they try out Rome and they're like, oh, this is how it works. Oh, these links, these backlinkings and the levels of transclusion and how you can block ref different things, you know, whatever it is. Being able to build the foundation for that seems like it's very, very difficult. And then Connor had it in his head the entire time as he's building it. So, you know, there's a little bit of serendipity already there, as you were there to become his first, I mean, I don't want to say test subject, but you know, you sort of were. and to prevent him from becoming an echo chamber, because you would be subject to your own biases if you're trying to build this writing app for yourself, or at least this Tools for Thought app. And you come in and you would realize what you need more. And now you have two minds working on the same app. Even if you're providing feedback and you're providing potential improvements or parts where you feel confused, etc. Mm. It's just nice to see that you were there to see the tool evolve over time. And now all of a sudden, there's this crazy movement on Twitter and everything. How do you feel about seeing the tool in its most basic form in 2017 and now in 2019 or 2020 when it's like got millions of dollars in investment and there's this crazy hashtag going crazy on Twitter and you have all these people talking about Rome all the time? I would love to hear your thoughts on it as someone who's been there from the very beginning.
Yeah, no, it's wild. This is going to sound strange, I think, but like I don't how do I put this? The exciting thing for me was in summer 2019 when we, like, I just happened to be there. I was in San Francisco with the Rome guys. And when they cracked like the final iteration, like, you know, basically the core product, the core of the product that went out into the world, and everything was working smoothly. And, you know, I didn't have to worry about a new iteration and losing my database or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I had the tool that I'd wanted Connor to build, except it was better than what I could have conceived of myself, much better. So that was far and away the most exciting thing prior to it actually blowing up, because my sort of, I guess my selfish motivation from this right from the outset was, I want this thing personally. Like this is a pain point in my life. So it was like, already, I think the peak is like it's being so satisfied that this thing exists. And I still feel that today. Like that I love all the quality of life improvements that are coming out. But I think for me, the core functionality is providing me with like 98% of the value. And I'm happy. Like I'm really happy with it. And it's like changed my life. So that's actually the big thing for me. But then, yeah, also, sort of multiply that out, and if there are other people who feel the same way that I do, who are experiencing like a major improvement to their work and their life, because they have access to that thing, I mean that's fantastic, isn't it? So it's thrilling that tens of thousands, 100,000 people are going through the same thing, and also just kind of bizarre as well. I'm from, you know, rural New Zealand. I'm not from Silicon Valley or New York City or anything like that. So it's slightly, it's been quite fun in a sort of outsider's point of view, seeing this thing blow up and get the big valuation and get sort of mobbed by users and, critics and everything. So yeah, it's been amazing just sort of like getting an insider's view on all of this without it sort of falling upon me directly. So, you know, the Rome guys work so hard and they've had to put out some fires along the way and deal with various crises and sort of, yeah, finally reap the rewards. Like imagine how Connor must feel, because when I'd met him, he'd already been trying to figure out this problem for so long, like for several years, I believe.
Yeah.
This was like his long-term game. And then, I mean, you must have something of an entrepreneurial mindset where you're willing to basically put in the work on something where you hope it will pay off, but you know that it will, that there's a reasonable possibility that it won't, or at least not in a direct financial return sort of a way. And like I have a little bit of that mindset, because I think you need that to write a book, for example, where you're sort of taking a punt and hoping that it works out. But imagine doing it for like years and years and years, and people probably think you're crazy and, you know, you've got no money and, you know, maybe your mum's wondering, like, what are you doing with your life sort of thing. And then it finally pays off and it looks like an overnight success, or, it looks like it was easy. It's a product design thing as well, is that product design should look simple, right? But it's not simple. And then it's like the tip of the iceberg, and then you have the 10 years of problems and pain and thinking behind it. So
yeah,
I'm so happy. It's been such a bizarre experience, and but ultimately, yeah, extremely satisfying personally and on behalf of like Josh and Connor and Victoria and others. Like, it's so cool.
Yeah, it's really awesome, especially when, well, one, we could hear your experiences on how the beta version of Rome is in 2017, and now all these incoming users are coming in 2020, and the app is now paid per month, and you know, a lot of bugs and flaws and all that back then, but people are still supporting, people are in the Believer plan, people are really adamant about sharing it with their friends and families. I have this, I don't know about you, but I have this want to tell people about Rome just because of how mind-blowing it is. It's crazy. And as much as we look at it as a simple writing app with a few key features that allow it to thrive, this app, what we're using right now, is the product of, I think it's 8 years. I think that's right. I think that's the right number. 8 years or 10 years of Connor's itch in trying to create this app. Like, he's been trying to answer this one question, and I can't really articulate the question right now, but I'm assuming it's something along the lines of, how can I build a hypermedia text thinking app for myself, or something along those lines, or at least help researchers. Maybe I can ask him, I don't know. If Connor, if you're listening to this, you can probably give me the question yourself. But anyway, so up to 8 to 10 years of accumulated knowledge, putting it into this one app and having you test it and having it out there. It's a very beautiful journey. And I think that's part of why this show has come about, because you can map out where everyone comes in. And like, if you can imagine like a Rome timeline, it's like, oh, 2010 or 2012, Connor started thinking about this app. And then 2017, he's in this retreat. And 2017 as well, you came in and you met him. And that's how the first version started. And now 2019, you have the app officially out. And 2020 is when it's, you know, when it's full on paid and everything. So it's a very, very amazing thing. The product of all his efforts is just something that I highly respect. And like you said, entrepreneurial mindset. To others, maybe he seems, you know, pretty out there. But to me, it's, you need that to build something like Rome. So on that note, how do you use Rome in your workflow? Because you said you're not really a technical person, but you've been there since the very first version. So I'm really curious as to how you started learning how to use Rome, and then he built a new version and you're like, oh crap, I have to start all over again. How are you using it then, and how are you using it now?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose just to give you a little bit of background context. So I already was doing a commonplace book sort of practice prior to meeting Connor, which is why I was immediately, I could sort of see what he was trying to do and was interested in it. I think it was from a blog post by Ryan Holiday, writing about how he takes notes from books on note cards and stores them.
I know that exact post. Yeah. Cause I did exactly the same. Yeah. In uni. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. I mean, that was like, you know, I owe Ryan thanks, because that was really influential on me. So I did that in Evernote initially. I was big into Evernote. This probably would have been in 2013 or 2014, I'd say. And that was really great. You know, practice was much better than nothing at all. But I could also pretty quickly stop care. I moved a lot of stuff to Google Docs, and then I had this huge sprawling complex of massive Google Docs that were like very crudely hyperlinked together or organized via bookmarks in my browser. Definitely a very crude commonplace book. I don't think you could even really call it like a system. I just got lost in the world. Probably when I was not easy to surface things, unless you've been very careful about how you arrange them. Google Docs, I'm basically just doing Control F, Command F searches to try and find things, and they're so huge that it takes like minutes to scroll to the bottom. It was cool, but obviously not workable for the long term. The first Rome iterations, I think what would have been the main things that kind of blew my mind, I suppose being able to filters were quite early, one of the early iterations. So being able to tag the various concepts and filter so that you could sort for, you know, this and or this but not that, and intersections between ideas which might have otherwise been unrelated. So in terms of the actual physical workflow, I'm curious what your experience is or what your guests have said, but for me, it's just constantly evolving. And I think it's probably slowed down somewhat, but I'm still occasionally thinking of better or different ways to do things and experimenting with it. And I deliberately don't pay too much attention to what other people were doing, because for some reason I just quite like thinking about it for myself or trying to come up with better use cases by myself. I don't know why. It's probably a kind of a dumb masochistic way of going about it. But so broadly speaking, I use the log days more and more and more. So that was one of the innovations that Connor came up with that I was initially dubious about. And as per usual, he was bang on the money. So rather than putting stuff on their own pages, I increasingly just put a heading and, you know, an H3 or something, and tag the relevant project or the relevant page or the relevant topic or just journal, and then indent beneath that and put whatever I'm working on. I usually timestamp it and then just as I'm writing, using the double square brackets. So then everything gets tagged back to the various pages mentioned. And then on pages themselves, there are some that will be standalone, like a standalone document or a standalone project, especially my writing pieces. Each writing piece is its own page. And then other ones, which are more or less just tags or topic categories, I'll sometimes in the body of that page, as opposed to the mentions, I'll sometimes reference blocks and sort of create some order from the mentions below. Or, you know, put a query on there when I want, rather than manually filtering the mentions. If there's like a couple of queries that I want to look at without having to do anything, then I'll put them on the page so that I can see that easily. And I think that's it for me. Like, I really like, someone tweeted recently, I can't remember what they said, but they were trying to explain the magic of Rome. And then rather than sort of getting lost and trying to, you know, be very poetic about how it changes you, the way that you think or the way that you do research, they said, you start writing, and when you want to link to something, you tap the square bracket twice and put the name in, and then keep going. And that's it, really. And then you could, I think, block references is like the next big thing that people probably find to be extremely useful. But fundamentally, it's not that complicated. And maybe thinking about nesting as well. Like, I do try to be thoughtful about my indentation in terms of what inherits what. But this is all the kind of thing that, for me at least, I've learnt as I've gone along. And rather than trying to have this perfect workflow from the outset, I think it's fine to just let it organically evolve as you go and figure things out.
Yeah, it's scary though. It's scary. That's why there's a lot of like online courses or, you know, like paid products that are trying to teach people. Like, it's basically trying to teach people that this is okay, right? It's like handholding to guide people to say what you're doing right now is perfectly fine, even if it's messy, even if it's chaotic. And I really do appreciate you sharing this because you know, not every Rome user's Rome system is super complicated. Like, I think mine is quite similar to yours, actually. Now that I'm writing it down and I'm looking at it, like, it, I feel like it's almost the same, except you mentioned that you would timestamp with headings for each post. So that, I think I would try to implement that. I think that's pretty interesting. Because at the moment I'm having trouble with, I'm trying to have less pages. And the reason why is that I look at pages as global blocks, my impression of the blocks within the page is now changed. Like, it doesn't have to be, the blocks within the page don't have to be everywhere. They don't have to be global. So it's perfectly fine for them to stay there. I don't have to move them to the corresponding page. I just nest it under a page square bracket name. And then I just leave it there. I leave it in the inbox. I leave it in the reference section. And then I will sort it out later. It's something, like you said, it's something that we learn over time. And like you, I also have stopped looking at other people's systems, workflows. I think it's more like a pastime now for me. It's like, oh, cool, right? It's not like I'm not there with the intention to learn. Maybe at most the principles behind it, like the reasoning behind it. Yeah. As much as I find agreements, disagreements, I will look at it and be like, oh, okay, cool. I wouldn't do that, but it's pretty cool that he or she came to that conclusion. Oh, this is great. Mm. Like, I don't know why. I get really excited hearing about people's workflows. You did mention just now that how other guests have viewed workflows. Theirs has also changed over time. And as much as the speed at which they are changing their workflows is slowing down as well, it actually, when you compare it to other apps, it's quite fast still. Like I think I remember a conversation with Maggie Appleton, which is a previous guest on the show, and she had a workflow tour, which was done a few months prior to our conversation. And she said that she looked back in the workflow and she was so annoyed or disappointed in herself. Like, she looked at her own system from a few months ago and it was so flawed and bad. Yeah. And she was like, oh, I could have done that better, or oh, I could have made my system prettier before I did a video. But it's just really funny to see.
Oh no, I have a similar thing. Back when, I can't remember exactly when, but just as Rome was launching, we were doing some kind of, I guess, like content marketing. And I wrote a guide to using Rome for getting things done, GTD, and emailed it out to the list. And I looked back on it after, I think, only after 3 months or something like that. And I'd completely changed my workflow and it looked like a kind of a, you know, an old fashioned dinosaur way to do things. So yeah, it's really funny. You just have to sort of... I suppose if you're doing any sort of guides or tutorials, just it's almost more like a work in progress than it is like, this is the prescribed way to do XYZ. And it also just seems to be a lot of personal preference in it. One common criticism of people who are big into these kind of tools and I guess knowledge management and productivity more broadly is that it's essentially a hobby. So a lot of it is like geeking out on the thing, not so that you can be more effective in the world, but just because, you know, you're getting distracted by the thing itself.
And right, right.
Yeah. So I would turn that around and say, well, who cares? Like, everyone has a hobby. This is cool. So go for it. Like, I, as much as I say, I'm happy with the product and I have a relatively simple use case, but now that I'm done with the book, I am planning to devote some time to upskilling and looking into how I could use the features better. And I probably will be looking at some guides and possibly taking a course, which is kind of funny. Like, from going from being like one of the tiny handful of people in the world who know Rome better than anyone, to almost immediately being overtaken by this incredibly passionate and talented community of the Rome cult. So yeah, I've got some upskilling to do. I've just been quite happily doing my thing in the background, and now that I have some free time ahead of me, I think I'm gonna dive back in and play with some of the new stuff.
I don't think you have that much to catch up with because you have done a lot already. That is the product of you using Rome for so long, and one of those is Optionality, your latest book, which I have it right here on my Kindle right now, and I'm reading through. I've reached book two, and I'm taking my time. I'm really, really taking my time reading through it. First of all, really funny. Like, I really like. I love reading through it. Like it's really your writing style is very vernacular. So I'm just really enjoying reading the book and like laughing to myself as I'm reading it in on the train or whatever. Congratulations as well on launching the book. Very beautiful design. But I'm going to play the fool here, which is a term I like to say from a different show that I work on, that I am not that financially savvy. Like, let's just play a role here. I'm not that financially savvy. I don't really think too much about the future. I'm just really trying to get by every day. I have a paycheck, living to it each and every month. And I've picked up this book and I see the word optionality. Could you give me your definition of what optionality is and why should I care?
Yeah, sure. So the simple definition I use for optionality is it's the right but not the obligation to do something. So you could do something if you wanted to, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
And I sort of build that out into a model in the book and explain why you should care. But the short condensed version is that the key to flourishing in life is being able to exercise your full capabilities as a human being in every domain. And there are various choices that people make in their lives that constrain their options or sort of lock them into narrow pathways and mean that their full capabilities forever lie dormant. And then there are other choices that you can make if you use a sort of a careful framework that unlock possibility and create serendipity and give you exposure to large life-changing outcomes. So, yeah, to the question of why should you care if you have optionality, other than the fact that I'm sort of developing it into a proxy for human flourishing in the book, is basically because there is no neutral choice. Like if you don't act in an intentional way, you'll still get an outcome. You can't just not choose. So if you go through life on a sort of passive default setting, then you'll get a passive default outcome. So I think there are like some very high leverage simple strategies that you can use to be more intentional about making those trade-offs, and rather than drifting through life, just slightly tweak the dial to do some things that have long-term payoffs, even if it's it costs you a little bit in the short term. So yeah, the main thing I'm looking for in the book is like I feel like I am a lazy person, or at least someone who wants to get ahead in life without having to bust my gut, like without having to really torture myself. So yeah, I've tried to collect a lot of suggestions that involve putting in relatively small amounts of effort, or in order to unlock the possibility of a very large potential outcome, or systems that just streamline your efforts so that you're not fighting against yourself or your environment or your social peers, and then that make the process of doing the work to unlock long-term gains, if not easy, at least not requiring a sort of Herculean effort or enormous outpouring of willpower.
Yeah, it's a great summary, actually. Yeah, I feel like the intersection between the right but not the obligation to do something, and then applying that same mindset or those principles to say, how can you view life? How can you thrive with the choices that you have right now? And how can you introduce specific choices that when taken, they lead you not to a future self you envision clearly per se, but more like set the foundation for a variety of options to pop up once you arrive at that future, which is quite a realization that I understand, but I have to take my time accepting it. Because it's kind of scary thinking about the future most of the time. So it's nice to know that there is this idea that having optionality within the different choices, the four domains within our lives, allow us to reach toward that. And then you can feel a lot more calmer about the different decisions that you have to make, as long as you're okay with them. I'm having a lot of fun with the book. And one potential thought that I had, and maybe you have a comment on it, is that there was a section on how there was no, I think you wrote that there was no human history. I think that was like something, a sentence like that, where people just have straight paths. Like if you have a if you have a family of farmers, like it's expected that the next of kin will be a farmer and the next of kin will be a farmer after that, you know, etc. It's a like pretty one track life. And only within recent times or within the 0.1% of the population can you have all these incoming options where you can try out a different path in life have popped up. So maybe from your time researching optionality within human flourishing, within that field, is optionality within that field a modern invention, or has it, is it more like a certain framework or a certain state of mind that is only accepted recently, but has always been there for a very long time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way to think about it is that optionality itself as a concept is very old. So at least 2.5 millennia, and you know, possibly older still. And it never, it's like, it's never a bad idea to look for options that have a small cost to take out and a potentially large upside. So these are the asymmetric opportunities, and they existed for, you know, from now until time immemorial. So it might help to give a concrete example. So the example I lead with in the book is sort of the classic introduction to optionality, which is a Greek philosopher called Thales, who he wanted to do philosophy and, you know, conduct his experiments, but, you know, he didn't have the necessarily have the means to do it. And his fellow townsfolk were kind of making fun of him. So he used his knowledge of astronomy and predicted that the olive crop would be especially bountiful in one particular year. So he bought the rights to use all the olive presses in his town, Miletus. And then when the olive season came round, sure enough, it was a bountiful crop. And everyone had to, he let out the olive presses to all the people on his own terms, having only paid a very small deposit to secure their use in the first place. And so got a very large asymmetric return. So if the olive season had not been that bountiful, he would have lost a small deposit and that's it. And if the olive season went gangbusters, which it did, then he would make a small fortune and set himself up for life, basically, so that he could pursue his actual interests. So that's the way that Aristotle tells it. And that's from, a couple of millennia ago. So that's the central model of optionality, which I think is useful to put out there to begin with, like looking for asymmetric options where the risk reward or the upside downside is heavily skewed towards having a you know, your costs are capped and limited, and the potential upside is unbounded. It could run on infinitely, essentially. And then in terms of the question of the value of optionality over time is really interesting. So my model of optionality is that it's valuable depending on the volatility of the domain in question. So in ye olden days, it is still valuable in that sense that we just discussed. Like, it's never not useful to be looking for options with those kind of asymmetries. But it's become much more valuable today because the world is changing so fast that you don't have certainty in planning your life outcomes. Like, it's very hard to make predictions about the future and set long-term goals. So you're much better off if you can sort of collect the raw ingredients of optionality, which, you know, things like money or being debt-free or having strong social support network and physical fitness, and then jump on opportunities as and when they present themselves without knowing what form they might take. That wouldn't have been so useful. Let's just talk about money just to make it simpler. So money is yep. almost like optionality incarnate. It's not exactly the same, but like it's another reasonably good proxy, because you have money and it gives you the option, right, but not the obligation. You can convert it into most things, not everything, but most things. And you can sort of just sit on it if you don't want to actually execute on anything. You can just sort of hoard your money indefinitely, right? So it's just optionality sitting there in your bank account. Now that's not that useful if your environment is predictable and if the world is not that volatile, because you know you can make long-term plans and you can actually you'd almost be foolish to just wait for something better to come along, because nothing will really change. Okay. There's no volatility in the domain, and it's not the case today. I think today you're much better off having broad options and maintaining some degree of optionality, which might be, for example, having a broad skill set. So being able to pivot so that if you're, well, two things. One is the protective effect, that if your particular domain or industry is automated out of existence, or, you know, you lose your job unexpectedly because a global pandemic hits or something like that, that you have other options, you have broader options that you can exercise, right? So that's kind of the resilience side of the equation. And then on the opening upside side of the equation, you can also jump on new opportunities that present themselves. So rather than being a domain specialist, which, you know, is obviously very useful, and I'm glad that they exist, but like if you are a generalist, you have a broad set of skills, then you're sort of poised to take advantage of new opportunities that come along without having to know what those opportunities will be or where they'll come from. So if you are if you're someone who just does your one job at, you know, widget making or whatever it might be, and you're very good at that, you can quite easily be volatility can wipe you out very easily. But if you're the guy at the widget factory, but you've also started teaching yourself to program and done some little projects or contributed to open source or something like that, and sort of put yourself out there, and then serendipity strikes and someone reaches out to you and they're interested in hiring you, or you see an opportunity in a business idea that you want to execute on, you can take advantage of that and expose yourself to, you know, potentially large upside. You see a trend before someone else does, and you're in a position to actually be able to do something about it. So, yeah, if optionality is the use value of it is mostly a function of volatility as well as your remaining time frame. Because, you know, like anything else, it's not much point having options when you are on your deathbed. That's why I think it's never been more valuable, and I would like to sort of signal boost the idea and broaden the use cases and get people thinking about it. It's also possibly a slightly, I'm not sure if it would be a contrarian idea or not, but definitely in the sense that people put a lot of stock in goals and planning and forecasting, and I think that's probably generally a bad idea, and that we should be we should try to make ourselves more tolerant of ambiguity and of being willing to take bets that will pay off in some way, but that we don't know for sure how they'll pay out, and be more flexible with our career planning and all this kind of thing. Like, don't lock ourselves into anything too early on with a huge student debt or a 7-year degree or whatever it might be. That's the case for optionality being more valuable in modernity than ever before. And I think the year 2020 when we're recording this has, you know, been quite vindicating for me in a personal sense, even though it's obviously been horrible for every other reason, because it has been a very strange world with, you know, great potential for ruin and also great potential for great possibility and potential for upside at the same time. So that's the case for optionality in the year 2020.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I don't want to say at a great time, having to book out at this time, it's quite timely, definitely. That's one way to put it, especially when you want to be resilient, say, against, I mean, what I call shock events, like this pandemic, or if your industry is wiped out. One real life example would be like what's happening right now where I am, is that airline companies have to lay off a lot of their air stewards and air stewardesses. So those are specialists like on the planes, like they're taking care of, you know, the ones that are flying. They are making sure that the plane is going perfectly fine. They are skilled only in that one narrow path, and all of a sudden they're laid off. What do they do? So there's like a whole bunch of people who are skilled in, you know, they are skilled air stewardesses, but they can't fly. So they have to take the time to learn a different skill, or they are just sitting at home, right? Like you're just sitting on your, like on your previous experiences that you can't even act upon right now. So resilience is then skilling yourself up in a different industry to protect yourself against potential shock events in the future or right now, because of all this happening. That kind of volatility is essentially what optionality is trying to protect you against. So it's more like contingencies, or it's more like plans against if this happens, I'm okay, right? Like if even though this decision I'm about to make is a bit ambiguous, even though I don't know what might happen, I'll be fine because my money is okay. I'm physically fit. I have many friends, or I'm with a partner that, you know, that is, that I'm happy with, and I'm skilled enough that I'm able to thrive and keep food on the table, which, you know, which is amazing, right? It's setting the foundation for our future self, which is what we're always living towards, because we're not really living backwards. So having that framework being applied to the domains that make up how we live is like a very powerful framework. I don't know if it's contrarian. I don't think so, but I think maybe it may be because you're applying optionality to multiple domains at the same time. So normally these domains have their own separate sets of values and principles and frameworks that most of the people adhere to.
Yep.
Applying optionality to those, maybe, I'm not sure, like, do a lot, are there, is there a population of people who like disagree with applying optionality to those? Or is it that generally when you released the book, a lot of people agreed with what you said? Was there a lot of backlash, or do you think people are very supportive of so far what you're saying?
Yeah. So I don't think that, I wouldn't describe the applying the concept of optionality across like non-financial domains. I wouldn't describe that as contrarian. Like, I hope it is useful to do that, to think about it in a more of a holistic sense. And I'm really excited to see where people take the concept as well. Like, I've already had a couple of people sort of emailing me examples of applying it to their own things that they know about, which I don't. This is, I think, probably, a lot of it is really common sense stuff as well. Yeah. So it's uncontroversial. Debt is negative optionality. Pay down your debt, you're in a much better position to weather future shocks.
Yes.
Have an emergency fund, invest in your family and friends, close relationships to weather storms. All this kind of thing is actually very common sense advice. I think the more contrarian position, and also the greatest criticism against optionality, is in the long-term planning or lack thereof. So the idea that you don't need to be a visionary, that you don't need a 20-year plan and then sort of work backwards and figure out exactly what you should do. Starting from your teenage years, if you're sort of brought up in the traditional Western education system where you make choices that will affect the rest of your life when you're 17 years old and your frontal cortex is still a blob of goo that hasn't sort of fully congealed yet. So it's like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So the strongest, here's the criticism of optionality that I have heard, not of my book yet, because I've sort of preemptively addressed this, but of the concept, which is people say that hoarding options is cowardly, essentially. So if you have the potential to do something but you don't do it, then you are you're a coward. Money is like quite a pure unit of optionality, even though it's not the full, it's only really one ingredient. But if you save up a lot of money and then never do anything with it, that's boring, you could deploy that capital where it could be more useful elsewhere. You could start a business, you could invest, you could give it away to people who could use it much more than you could. So I agree with that criticism. And I have like a large section in the book explaining kind of where you run into the point of diminishing returns from stacking up options versus actually executing on the ones that you already have. And then the other criticism, which comes from sort of the Peter Thiel types, it's like a very Silicon Valley thing, is that this argument that great people invent the future and they don't have a fuzzy attitude towards the future where they just sort of pivot several times and jump on new opportunities and go through this process called effectuation. So I talk about this in the book as well. I think it's possible that that idea has some merit, but I think it's highly unlikely to be useful for the majority of people. So I think right. It applies to perhaps some people who are trying to do really transformative things. So Elon Musk might be a good example of planning anyway, because you know, most people are terrible at making predictions, basically. And I also think that there's probably a lot of survivorship bias at work, where you have people who succeeded and they look like visionaries, but actually they're very, because I look for case studies and they're very few and far between. Like the great majority of people who are successful, they didn't actually have that in their mind from a very young age or whatever. They really did get sort of buffeted around by the storms of serendipity and jump on opportunities that presented themselves and abandon bad ideas, the whole idea of, you know, failing fast and pivoting to better opportunities.
It's not exactly the same path that everyone is willing to go towards. So I appreciate that you're able to like bring it up within the book up front so that people don't have to worry about it beforehand. Like optionality is something that everyone can accept and understand and then apply. And it's not for the most, you know, it's not for the most, like, it's not for world changers or anything like that. It's for everybody, including world changers, but it's up to you to set the foundation for that. I have something that I wanted to bring up, actually, that is highly related to this. It's a quote from your book, which it made me laugh, and two, I wanted to ask you something about it. So from the book, the passage is this, quote, "What's your 10-year plan is a strange question, not trusting 18-year-old Richard because he was a dumbass." So first of all, that made me laugh. But I do agree. Asking yourself right now, what's your 10-year plan? It's like asking yourself to pick and choose everything for the next 10 years. It's already hard for me to choose what clothes I want to wear for the day, but to figure out what I actually want to do for the next 10 years. Yeah, exactly. Right. But to do that for 10 years, like how many days is that? Right. That's like, you know, like I can't even, it's like 3,000 days, right? That's insane. Right. So
4,000 days.
Yeah, exactly. So instead of what's your 10-year plan, maybe to either probe yourself towards optionality or at least probe yourself towards the foundations to become a little bit more future oriented, but to still accept the ambiguity of the future. What's a better question to ask yourself when it comes to thinking about the future or to think about taking the first few steps to building these domains, these options?
Oh, that's a really good question. Just as a sort of preamble. So there are things that we know that we want in the future that we don't need to be some kind of like Nostradamus to predict, right? So this is the whole idea that I mentioned in the book of be a bad idea to have an emergency fund to have, work on building social capital and meeting new people and solidifying existing relationships and to protect your health. So, you know, protect against downside shocks to your, you know, physically, and also give yourself, put yourself in a position to be high energy and physically fit and able to the extent that you can. And so we know that we will want all of these things in 10 years time. I know that my 10-year plan is that I want to be in good shape. I want to have good relationships. I want to be in a good financial position, and I want to have broad skills and knowledge, right? And I don't need to know what that will look like. I don't need to know if I'll be doing open water swimming or if I'll be doing weightlifting. I don't need to know exactly who will be in my life or what, who they will connect me with. I don't need to sort of plan that out like some kind of, sociopathic LinkedIn troll or whatever. And I don't need to know what I'll be working on, which is a strange thing to say. But I need to know, like, I think, what's a better way of putting this? Like, start with what does a good life look like and then work backwards from there. So for me, what a good life looks like, besides the things I've already mentioned, is having fulfilling work to work on, you know, having good relationships, having good health. And that's about it. That's about as good as it gets. So you could say that you want to optimize for having those things. And then it doesn't actually matter, like, to a huge degree, the fine detail of what those things look like. You don't have one soulmate floating around. There's not some tiny handful of people in the world who you can be friends with. There's not one career that there's not only one career that you could possibly work in. So, yeah, I think that would be the right way to think about it. And then my argument in the book is that you should be sure to accumulate these raw ingredients of optionality so that you can put yourself in the best position to. To leverage each of those fields in a way that makes sense at the time, at any given point in time. So I am a writer and I'm pretty good at writing. I'm not going to be winning the Pulitzer Prize anytime soon, but I feel like if I went back in time, the world is so interesting. I'm very confident I could have been a good architect or dentist or landscape gardener. I don't believe in this idea that there's one thing that you can do and you have to follow your passion and make it into a reality. I think that if you focus on having good systems and exposing yourself to possibilities and not getting trapped into something that you can't escape from, that you will eventually just sort of gravitate towards something that that gives you a good life and that you find fulfilling and personally satisfying. And that if things ever changed, you could sort yourself out and sort of do another pivot or change careers or change relationships or whatever it might be. So it's sort of a position of power to be in, really, a position of stability and resilience. Rather than saying, when I'm 17 years old, the example I use in the book is that I was sure I was going to be a lawyer when I was a child. I have no idea how this got into my head, but that was my career path. And I remember telling the principal about it when I got admitted to high school. So I must have been 12 or 13 years old. That was what I was going to do, right? Yeah. And there would be a universe in which I sort of rigidly stuck to that's my vision, right? And went to law school and, you know, assuming I could get in and became a lawyer. And I think that would have been a disaster. It would have been maybe, you know, a good life. I mean, you're probably you're much more comfortable as a professional worker than most people around the world, but still, like, it would have massively constrained my options. I would have had a huge debt. I don't think I would have been good at it. I suspect I would have disliked it, although, you know, you can never be sure. So yeah, I think that's probably a good personal example. I mean, my entire life is just a string of happy coincidences, really. So whenever I've, you know, anything that I've tried to be visionary about, I've been very glad that it hasn't worked out in the way that I anticipated. And that I've waited to sort of align what I want to do with my own interests and passions and things that I would do for free, more or less, you know, like that's, I suppose that's the dream for me. I don't know. How do you feel about working? Do you like work? The idea of work?
Yeah. I like meaningful work. I think I did this exercise a long time ago in that I was trying to figure out, like, I used to play a lot of games beforehand, and you know how you have a lot of character traits and skills for, like, a character. I was trying to apply that to a job. So what are the traits of this job that make it a high level character? Things like visible impact or an alpha version of optionality, where what is the low effort, huge benefit ratio of this job, like either by impact or the amount of time I'm putting in, which will result in this metric or something like that, or the money, right? Like, what are the options I can get once I earn this much, you know, things like that. I realized that the impact was the largest character trait I was trying to find in the job that I'm trying to do. For anything. So I had a full-time job, then I quit, then I started doing freelance, and the amount of time to rest and the amount of time to think and the amount of time to execute was also very important. So like visible impact and time. Those two turned out to be the traits that I always want to look for whenever I try to find work. So because I can now choose the work I can do, I can now find work that has those two traits prioritized over anything else. Like maybe, I mean, as long as there's still money, I mean, because, you know, money is a unit of optionality. I realized that I've started putting in elements of optionality in doing the work that I do. Therefore, I love work. So like I like to do meaningful work because I now have the option to choose work that I do that is parallel with what I want to do, that I like to do, that I like to pay attention to. So I don't know if there's a way to like fit, like when I was reading your book, one of the things that I like to point out in my head, at least, is that I like to look at currencies of life. So like attention, time, money. And I was trying to figure out how can you apply optionality to attention as a currency? So like whether it's skills to focus on, knowledge to go into a deep dive, is it relevant? Maybe not. So does that mean that's low value attention, etc.? I realized that work is put under the umbrella of attention because it's work that I choose to do, and that I can only achieve that because I chose to, like I had the option to quit and work on this myself. Therefore, it's much more meaningful. Although it's because of that I'm failing in my other domains because I like doing this so much that I'm not really physically able. Like I'm not going to the gym as much, but that's a whole other story. But to me, work is meaningful. Work is something I strive towards. And skills that I learn or that I pick up on the way are vehicles towards that. So I think you mentioned in your book, you have terminal goals and instrumental goals. So my terminal goal, is work that has an impact, and my instrumental goal is skills that allow me to go towards this end goal. Any skill that works under that umbrella, the ability to maintain a system that allows me to do that each and every single day makes work worth doing. And I think that is like heavily aligned, like really, really aligned and parallel with what you just mentioned, which is have great systems and your future self will be perfectly fine.
Yeah, no, that's the perfect exemplar, really, because what I'm trying to do with the book is not so much get people to become filthy rich or become millionaires or whatever. Although obviously that would be nice. It's more to just improve the quality of people's lives. And I think, like, for me at least, work is very fulfilling. And the only reason it is, or one of the reasons that it is because I could do other things if I wanted to. So I don't have to work with people I don't like. And if I had a boss who was really horrible and shitty, I wouldn't be locked into working there. I could just say fuck you and walk out the door if I had to. Like it's so powerful. It's so powerful to have that in your pocket. Right.
Yeah.
So, that is the idea, is that like for a lot of people, work is genuinely horrible and soul destroying, because the working conditions that they have are not good, and they don't have the power in that relationship. And they don't have the ability to walk away, and they're not exercising their full capabilities as a human being. So this is why we have this sort of societal, meme that work is bad, and you know that you should work is something that you should do only insofar as it lets you pay the bills, and then you escape at the earliest possible opportunity.
Yeah.
So, I would like to sort of, you know, to get enough optionality in terms of broad knowledge, skills, cash, career capital, and so on, relationships and networking, to move into work that they actually like and actually find meaningful. I think that's possibly the most underrated or most powerful thing that anyone can do, only insofar as there is this kind of narrative that like work is bad and you have to retire as young as you possibly can, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's that mandatory aspect that makes work have the impression that it's bad, right? Like a lot of mandatory work is like the end goal or the terminal goal is to get money. I think like, unless you really are striving to be a lawyer or a doctor, then it's perfectly fine. Like, the money aspect or the other capitals, the other domains are covered as a side benefit, but that's not the primary goal. Like, if you want to be a doctor, you want to save lives or something along those lines. But to have the option to walk away means that it does not become a part of your soul, like a part of your character. And therefore, if you want to rest, if you want to take a break, you will be perfectly fine. You don't have to ask permission. Your domains are perfectly covered. You are safe and sound, and that's perfectly okay. And I think optionality would fit well as a tool to help people pursue that, a unique version of that into their lives. Because it may not be the same for, like, it may not be the same for you, and it may not be the same for me, but options for other people may come in different forms. And we just have to try to thrive or strive towards them, no matter what shape or form they might come up with, because, you know, the future is quite ambiguous, but we want to be well prepared. Actually, I do want to ask, I've been trying to think of a way to intersect optionality and a Rome graph. So I'm curious as to, maybe you've actually tried to do this when you're writing your book through a Rome, but do you find it easy to determine whether options, like certain options or opportunities that come up in your life, are good and bad, and or you have frameworks that work really well because you have Rome as a tool? Like, do you have...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, do you see like certain features help you with visualizing the relationships between, oh, is this a good thing to do? Should I pursue? Should I quit? Should I go ahead with this? Do you see, like, have you ever thought about that before?
I mean, basically, there are some options that are so obvious that it doesn't require me to do any great thinking to realize which way the asymmetry goes. So, like, you know, a glaringly bad option where, taking an addictive drug, or you know, driving around with insurance on my car or something, like, I could cap, you know, there's no real upside there, but there's massive potential downside. So some things are just no-brainers, and then there are no-brainers in the opposite direction as well, where I can see, like, if I email someone that takes me, who I admire, that takes me 2 minutes or 5 minutes, and possibly I can build a relationship with them that could change my life, or, you know, that could be really really rewarding. So there are other things that are that don't require a lot of introspection or thought. But something I do a lot in Rome, and it's partly just a function of free flowing writing, is figuring out, like, if this, then that. One thing that would be really cool is, I actually have this idea, like what you were saying before about having applying the skill tree from video gaming to a career or something. I think it would be cool to do that for, like, life in general, and have, like, this gigantic, like, polymath skill tree, and you can go down different paths and you can see where they intersect and which ones lead to the to higher level skills, and sort of, like, track your progression in different domains of development and aesthetics and other things. So that would be cool. That's something I'm just sort of starting to think about doing in Rome, although I'm not actually sure if Rome is the perfect place for it. What I do is, when I'm trying to make decisions and think about what's upside, what's a downside, is I will write, and then I will create sort of dependencies. So, you know, tag... this leads to this concept, leads to this concept. And this is also what I did when I was structuring the book. Under conditions of X, this leads to Y. And then I can sort of see represented on the page or in the little graph interface where I'm going and in what directions. So I think it's probably more useful for actually figuring out some of that middle ground stuff where it's not glaringly obvious whether it's a good idea. And then the other, probably more powerful way I do it is just by consistently tagging things like, let's say I'm curious about my mood. So I will tag mood, and then I'll write about like if I had a conflict or if I had a particularly happy event or something. And then I'll also tag in any relevant factors, like, you know, had I drunk some alcohol or how was my sleep or whatever. And I think that over time I will be able to draw connections between those things and start to pick up on patterns, and see that in certain contexts, this makes me feel better. And here's the evidence of it that I can see going back through my database over many years. Or, you know, I should avoid this thing after having done this thing. So those patterns, I think, take some time to develop, but I'm already starting to see the fruits of that. I think the way that Connor talks about it is like doing science, like do science on your own life. Try to look for patterns and track variables and then see what you can learn about yourself. So yeah, that's definitely a really satisfying thing to do, which I'm sure all the Romans who do any sort of journaling will really appreciate. It's like Rome is an engine for serendipity, because you're conversing with yourself as you do when you journal in the moment, which is useful already, but you're also conversing with like your past selves and your future selves in a way. Like you can sort of talk, you can pass lessons like forward in time. So yeah, I think that will increasingly be useful for me, because it is the kind of thing that depends on having a fairly consistent practice over some time in order to get the data. But as a framework for making decisions, well, it very much helps to actually understand how your current decisions are affecting you and actually have some kind of record of what's working and what's not working in your life.
Yeah, having the interface up on Rome, like either on your laptop or wherever. I'm not sure how you feel whenever you turn when you open your Rome graph. For me, as soon as I open my Rome graph, I'm meeting three people at the same time, right? Like my present, my past, my future, and then there is me.
Yeah.
Because at least to me, in my head, I think in characters, so different facets of life. So, my first person view of myself when writing and my second person view of myself when writing, where both come from the present, are two different people. So that's already a conversation in itself, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
or between different factions of your mind as well, if you're
exactly.
If you're sort of weighing something up and you have to almost like argue with yourself on the page.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I can recognize if blocks are from the second person view version of myself or my first person. It just by looking at seeing like, oh, I or you, right? Is it when it's I, it's I'm pondering about something.
Oh,
I'm unsure. I don't know. Right. Should I? Right. Should I go ahead? Or I'm just reporting what happened. But then if it's second person, it's logic talking back to me from outside the box, like, you shouldn't do this, right? This is what happened last time.
Wow.
You hated it. You fucked up. You should stop, right? Stop. Like, you know, like, let's just say, like, I drank so much last night, right? And my friend invited me to go out to drinks again. I don't feel that great about it, but I like my friend, so it should be okay. Should I go? And then the next block is like, you're not happy when you're with him. Or like, you're not really... You're not really enjoying as much. Like you prefer to be doing something else. You should be reading a book, right? And then I'm like talking, I'm arguing with myself a lot. Luckily I don't have a page for arguments, because then the node for that will just be this giant, giant circle that will cover the it will encompass the entirety of the graph. But I have a lot of those self conversations. So I really do appreciate
that's really funny. Yeah, I do the exact same thing, but I hadn't conceptualized it like that. I've noticed that I was sometimes using the first person and sometimes using the second person.
Yeah.
But you're exactly right. The first person is like the uncertain raw me, and the second person is like giving instructions almost, even though it's happening at the same time. Saying like, this is what you gotta do, not do. Yeah, that's great. I like that.
And it's only like I've had that idea or that outlook on writing for years, but it hasn't fully formalized until I tried out Rome. And I think it's because when I started using Rome, it's becoming more accepted that I try to explore my own system, which was, like you said, like you prefer not to look at other people's workflows. You'd rather just explore and find out yourself, because that's setting the rules for acceptance in your own Rome graph, as opposed to trying to find the most ideal 120% productivity guide to using Rome and imitating somebody else's system and putting it on yourself. I've tried to do that for other apps before I used Rome, and people always talk about their system being the best. So I thought, okay, let's just imitate them and then see what happens. And I remember that I would do this for myself in notebooks, like writing on pen and paper, and it was okay because the world is noise and I'm in my own quiet zone when I'm in my notebook, but now I'm just applying it to Rome. So like having these rules properly accepted, first person and second person, makes it much more better. So yeah, it's nice to have Rome there being able to cover that that part of me.
yeah. It'd be so fun to look back in subsequent years as well. Well, maybe not fun. Maybe fun's not the right word, but interesting.
Probably meaningful is probably a better way. The one thing that I'm scared of doing is to make a page in my graph called you and then just bring it up, all of it. I'm so scared of doing that. Like, I think, well, one, it will lag my graph. And two, I'm so scared about my second person self telling me, why didn't you listen to me? Right. Like things like, what the hell? Like, why didn't you listen to me do this? Like, but yeah, but so we are coming up on time, but I thought I could finish up with a couple of segments at the end of our talk, and maybe we could have round two another time. But for now, Richard, the first question I would like to ask is, how would you describe Rome to someone who hasn't started using it yet?
I would describe it as, it depends what their frame of reference is, if they're already into this kind of thing or not. I think I would describe it as a tool for thinking, or even a tool for introspection, like a tool for thinking about what you know and how you know it, and connecting those ideas together. I don't think I'd try and go for anything elaborate or too poetic. It's a good question, though. I think this is the question, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's really it is. Well, you might say this is the question, but the next one may be a contender for that as well. So the next question is, what does Rome mean to you?
What does Rome mean to me? Yeah, I suppose it is my augmented brain, really. It's my artificial memory. As I'm getting older, I'm definitely struggling to remember things and sort of running out of bandwidth. And so, yeah, it is like my repository of like past versions of myself, which I can access with much more reliability than my own sort of lossy wetware. So it means a lot, like, because I have the journaling practice and, you know, because I've already actually been using it for a few years, I can look back and sort of relive moments and insights and have like a more fully fleshed out conception of who I am and who I have been, and where I'm going. So yeah, it's again hard to answer, because as Rome has improved and as I have improved on my own workflows, everything's getting sucked into it. Like, I'm using it for almost everything now at this point. Like, apart from, I have a bunch of Google Sheets for, you know, calculations, which we haven't got to yet, but you know, like journaling, my weight training stuff, nutrition, sort of my wardrobe purchases and acquisitions, all of my essays, my blog, my book. I wrote the whole book in Rome. My contact management system for sort of keeping track of conversations with people, my introspection on conflicts or on my mood and my temperament, and then my annual reviews, where I sort of look back at everything and think about what I want from the next year and what's gone well. So if Rome disappeared right now, I would be heartbroken. Like my life would be, I wouldn't be because of this sort of sea change in tools that has come in the wake of Rome. So, you know, like Obsidian, you know, I'm probably getting in trouble for saying this, but it's a nice product. So, you know, I could probably, you know, Rome will always be the one true, you know, the one true tool, but, I could certainly make do with something else, I suppose, and be able to have most of that functionality or not all of it, but at least a huge step change over my previous Evernote and sprawling Google Docs empire. So yeah, it's just it is really a big part of my life now. I never don't have Rome open, you know. I'm looking at Rome most days for one thing or another, like for hours out of every day. So it's quite bizarre. It's a huge part of my life.
It's beautiful. And don't worry, you won't get in trouble for mentioning Obsidian. It's already been mentioned before a couple of times on the show.
You'll have to bleep that out.
No. There's another app that I would prefer to bleep out because of a lot of beef between Connor and that. But don't worry, that is for another time. And actually, there is one question that I have uniquely for you, and I've just found it in my Rome graph. So there's this one section in your book where you were talking about what you said before, where money is a unit of optionality. And one of the ways to measure that or to track that is net worth. So I was trying to think of a way to intersect Rome and optionality and basically things that were mentioned in your book. And I was thinking about this, and maybe you have you ever thought about this before? Calculating your net worth is, you know, all of your assets and all of your debts put together. But do you think in the future, would you consider putting your knowledge graph or your Rome graph as part of your net worth? Like, would the value of that increase over time as you put all these things in your Rome graph? Or do you think that because it only stays as a repository of information, it has no monetary value?
That's a good question. It does have monetary value in the sense that I would pay, a fairly large sum to not lose it, you know?
Yeah.
If you put a gun to my head and say, you know, maybe I shouldn't give people ideas, but, you know, I'm going to hold your Rome database hostage. How much you want to pay? Yeah, I think for the net worth side of things, I wouldn't include any intangible assets. Because that is more of a pure metric of financial optionality. But the whole reason why I wanted to apply the model more broadly to other aspects of life is that for this exact reason of thinking slightly laterally about what it means to be wealthy and what things are of value to you.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that, when I was younger, I suppose, when I was in my 20s and, you know, getting an education and starting my commonplace book and so on, like my knowledge capital is actually the most valuable part of my portfolio as a person, right? Like I didn't have any money, and actually I had some debts, right? So that's hugely powerful, because I could leverage that into doing very well on financially. So I don't know if it makes sense to try and put a dollar value on intangibles like that,
right?
But like they clearly do have a dollar value. Like everyone kind of shits on university degrees and credentialism. I mean, I kind of dunk on it in the book a little bit as well. But even like having a university degree on average increases your lifetime earnings by $1 million or something like that over a person who hasn't gone to university. So yeah, it definitely makes sense to think of this is why I describe knowledge capital as capital, because it costs something to acquire. And then you deploy it in the service of getting, getting leverage on it, earning an outsized return on your capital that you've acquired, right? It's kind of a not perfectly intuitive way to think about it. I think probably people are used to thinking about knowledge capital, but health capital and social capital, I think, are slightly more strange to think about in monetary terms, or at least in sort of capitalistic terms of strategically acquiring it strategically cultivating people in your life or whatever that might look like. But definitely a useful thing to do. So yeah, like as part of my annual review, I look at my core metrics, which are things like net worth and expense ratios for the financial domain. But then I have other metrics that I look at in other parts of my life to make sure that I'm on track with everything. So even if I can't put a dollar value on them, I am looking at how I'm going over time in those well balanced and, you know, working on all of the you're trying to be like a well-rounded person.
Yeah, I can see that even if you can't put a dollar value to it, it's just as important. So I was just curious about what's your take on it. Because part of the term net worth is worth, right? So like beyond the measurable numerical implications of this domain, what is this worth? Like whatever this type of capital can be, what is it worth to you? And why do we still spend time trying to grow it? Because of the second order benefits or the second order effects, like the low cost and huge upside behind growing your knowledge capital so much that you can use it to acquire more financially, as an example, or gain better relationships because you're more well-equipped to handle better conversations or higher quality conversations, for example. Like, that's a possibility. Appreciate that. Thank you so much for that. That's pretty cool. We're stopping here for now, but if another time when you are launching your next book or once you're done skilling up on your Roam skills... Richard, thank you so much for coming onto the show. If we want to reach out to you for anything that we talked about in this conversation, or if we want to check out your book, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, so if you visit thedeepdish.org, you can find my contact details. And I encourage people to email me and reach out. And I do try to reply to everyone who contacts me. I'm definitely interested in connecting with people, especially from the Roam community. And if you go to optionalitybook.com, then you can find the book and a bit of a preview and all the retailers. So it's available on in various formats. Hopefully at some point on Roam. So yeah, maybe we could do a part two at some point because it's definitely been interesting structuring the book in Roam on the back end and then presenting it as a hypertext book. I think will also be interesting and perhaps, you know, a new trend in the Roam universe. So I'm looking forward to working on that.
I never got to ask you about that actually. Oh, okay. Well, we'll save it for another
time. We'll save that. We're gonna say something for part two. Yeah.
And also, I forgot to ask this as well. Where did the name The Deep Dish come from?
So that came from my initial stunt where I ate the 222 pizzas in a row.
Yeah. So for our listeners, eating 222 pizzas in a row may not seem like a recommended idea to do, but you can always reach out to Richard for advice on eating that many pizzas, as well as everything that we talked about in this conversation. So of course, links in the show notes right below to this episode. Richard, thank you so much. And I will see you on Twitter or email or anywhere.
Yeah. Thanks, Norm. My pleasure.